Papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis where we try to give you some insight into newsroom decision making with some veteran journalists. We welcome you. I'm Rex Smith, former editor of the Times Union, here with my colleagues, Judy Patrick, the former editor of the Daily Gazette of Schenectady. We have Barbara Lombardo, who was executive editor of the Saratogian and the Troy Record, and Ian Pickus, the news director of Northeast Public Radio, WAMC. Hello, y'all.
Hello, let's do it.
Howdy.
We have some things to talk about. Actually, we need to start close to home because people who listen to this program no doubt are very familiar with NPR News and therefore probably have followed the saga of Uri Berliner, the senior editor on the NPR business desk, who wrote an essay that was digitally published about how the outlet has lost America's trust because of what he perceived as something of a left-wing bias that manifested itself in some flawed reporting. Uri was subsequently suspended for 5 days. Essentially, that is a five-day unpaid vacation, and then has decided to resign. He would leave NPR. While he did write in his post as he was leaving, "I wish NPR well. I think that they do great journalism, and I do not support calls for defunding." Notwithstanding that, there is a huge push now on the right, certainly Fox News and its, let's say, supporters, to say we shouldn't be sending any money to public radio. So what do we think about this? How about inside public radio world? What do you think about this, Ian? Where are we going?
Well, I've had a couple weeks to think about it, and there are a few things that stick out to me. Number one is the desired effect. I'm still mystified by what he thought he would accomplish by doing this. And I say that as somebody who has seen complaints and hate mail and letters coming to WAMC that might not have otherwise come here had he not uncorked this Molotov cocktail into the public media system. I think that, first of all, every newsroom in the public media system is running its own race. And they're all different. They all have different characteristics and different rules. And they're all aiming toward the same thing, I think, which is to do good local news if they're lucky enough to have the staff. Unfortunately, the average person out there thinks of member stations like ours as synonymous with NPR. And so he's hurt all of us by releasing this essay. And I'm not surprised that he's not going back to work there. I don't see how that would have been possible. I don't know what he expected to happen other than this eventual outcome, a firestorm and the end of his 25-year career. The second thing I would say about it is that public radio is liberal, lowercase l, in that what we cover and the types of stories that we do are open to the world in a holistic way, where a corn festival can get the same interesting 4 minutes that the House bill on Ukraine can get. And that's what's great about it. There is something for everybody there. It is all things considered literally. The part of his essay that really bothered me is this assertion that because conservative listeners have apparently broken away from listening to NPR and public media as much, that is the fault of public media at a time when we know the right is being told, don't believe anything you see or hear constantly, it's fake. And so I think a lot of the blame does not belong with the public media system, which I can tell you, we sweat over every comma and every word in the stories, and fairness and accuracy and tone, these are things that we torture ourselves over to get right. When we have people from the Republican Party on the air, we get complaints that we're platforming the right too much here in public media. So I would say his essay points to the fact that these outlets are a work in progress. That is the very nature of it. I've talked on this show about the sandcastle. Every day we build the sandcastle, every day the tide comes in and we try again. We are not ever perfect. The ideal is on the horizon. Yes, that is all true. We are pushing in that direction. But to say that because of the news of the past decade, which has been so challenging and unprecedented, that the conservatives have turned off NPR and that's NPR's fault, I find difficult to swallow. And that's the end of my soliloquy.
It was good soliloquy. What do you think, Barbara?
I thought that Ian's comments were really excellent on all fronts. I can appreciate the individual's dilemma. So you work for an organization, and in his case, for 25 years. So you believe in being a part of that organization and what their goals are. And you believe in your heart that they are falling short in a way that needs to be changed and exposed. First, you try to do it internally. So then what are your options when internal attempts to change what you and your heart believe to be wrong fail? So I'm kind of projecting what I think he's thinking. So what does he do? He uses an outside vehicle to express his thoughts. So that's what he did. And that was going to go nowhere good. I think that what he needed to do was step away and then provide whatever information he wanted to the public, then do his criticism, not as a member of the organization anymore, but just saying, I see the need for change and I'm going to say it, but I'm not going to be part of the organization. However, whether he's part of the organization or not, the damage is done. And that's a big concern to me, that it hurts national NPR's reputation and that it has that trickle-down effect to hurt the funding for member organizations. I think it's also a reminder for journalists of see how it feels when criticism from an employee is made public. And as journalists, you sort of like it when you hear critics from other public and private institutions speak out about what they believe to be wrong within their organizations. And we applaud it and we might follow it, depending on what it is. We might disregard it or we might pursue it and give it some legs. And it doesn't feel as good when it's coming against ourselves.
Judy Patrick, you've had instances in your newsroom, I'm sure, where you've had internal criticism about decisions that are made and that I suppose, as Barbara's pointing out, if they were aired publicly, it would be embarrassing.
It's true. And again, as we've talked about before, we hire these people to have opinions, to challenge authority, to raise questions, to express their opinions within the newsroom. And then they want to express those opinions and challenge the authority. But when it goes public, it's damaging to the reputation of the organization, and it can do some real damage. This story has had legs. We're still talking about it, and I think that's a testament to how important NPR is to so many people, that they care about the institution and they want to see it survive. You know what? Trust is down in media across the board. 25 years ago, did conservatives believe that NPR was liberal? Certainly they did. That has been accelerated, as Ian points out, by the fact that the right-wing politicians continue to hammer home that NPR is too liberal. I would just encourage people to listen to NPR. Go to their website. Look at the stories they have chosen to do and decide for yourself. I would argue that they tend to take issues, social issues, that people on the right wing would consider to be left-leaning issues. I would think that they were real issues. I think they've made a concerted effort in the last few years to have more conservative voices on the air and to get those counter viewpoints. But the idea of going public with internal criticism, I shudder at the notion, but I agree with Barb. As reporters, we love it when someone inside starts to criticize the company and we put headlines on it. So aren't we hypocrites?
You know, it's interesting that he ran afoul of the rule that employees at NPR are required to get prior approval before publishing elsewhere. We had that in the contract at the Times Union. That is a part of the contract with the news between the newspaper guild and the company. And I would sometimes have to tell someone, no, you actually can't write for that magazine. That is too much a competitor of ours. But it didn't have to do with internal criticism of what's going on. You know, sometimes in an organization, if you are not in charge, you have to accept that decisions may be made that are not those that you would make. And that is just the way organizations work. Somebody ultimately has to be the person who answers. And Uri, I have to just again say by way of clarity here, Uri was an old friend of mine. We were classmates in journalism school 100 years ago, roughly speaking. But, you know, the very fact that this dispute is so public, that we're talking about it so much, is, I think, a mark of the vitality of journalism. It is the fact that these kinds of conversations take place. This is not all rigid adherence to a norm. People dispute all the time how stories should be covered and worry that, oh, gee, we didn't do that quite right. And, you know, we need to do that better, as Ian says, the sandcastle. We need to build the sandcastle more sturdily tomorrow. But the fact is that the factual reporting of what's going on in America is offensive to the right wing in American politics. We see that all the time. Factual, straight, honest reporting is denigrated by MAGA world. And that is just the way it is. And so to now have that as though it is something that NPR should be ashamed of, I think they should be very proud of the fact that their reporting has brought out that kind of denigration from the hard right, because it is truth-telling that is causing the annoyance of that political group.
You know, there's been some criticism of the Berliner piece for having inaccuracies in it as well, and not acknowledging the fact that covering some of these very contentious issues, especially during the Trump year, has been an evolution, that the stories develop over time, that you don't give all the facts right up front. And I also like to take a good hard look at the body of Yuri Berliner's work. What has he done? If I was a reporter and I was unhappy with what my newsroom was producing, I would offer counter stories. Did he propose stories that were killed? I would have loved to see that kind of information in his essay.
One more thing from my perspective, and this is something WAMC's newsroom has a lot of fun with sometimes, but, you know, NPR is a Rorschach test for what you yourself are hearing. We're talking about 24-hour news. We're talking about a number of different programs, all with a different editorial bent, perhaps, or a different focus. So are we talking about the hourly newscast of headlines? Are we talking about the news magazine show? Are we talking about Fresh Air? It's hard to paint with such a broad brush. All I know is, on my way to work today, I heard an interview with a member of the Freedom Caucus on the air explaining why this particular person does not want to fund Ukraine's resistance, and also why this particular person does not think it's a bright idea to get rid of Speaker Mike Johnson. Okay, that was the 10 minutes I spent in the car today. If that was the only exposure I had to NPR today, I might think, why are they so right-wing?
That's excellent. Absolutely. And by contrast, think of Fox News. I heard a commentator on this station make a comparison to NPR to say, well, it's like when I turn on Fox News, I think they're telling the truth from that perspective. And I'm thinking, how can that possibly be true? By the very nature of the story selection, even the so-called straight news of Fox News is tremendously biased by what they decline to cover and by what they focus on to such a great degree. The reason that America is so inflamed about immigration is because Fox News, in an effort to support the right-wing politicians, which is the goal of Fox News, remember, has focused so much on immigration at the border. Not that there isn't an immigration issue, but the fact that it hasn't been solved and the fact that it is being viewed as a danger to America is because of the distortion by Fox News. So that is a false equivalence to suggest that there is NPR on the left and Fox on the right. Fox News blatantly, intentionally lies. NPR does everything it can, I think, to get the story straight while trying to tell the whole truth.
And we know Steve Inskeep doesn't call the president every night at 10 to strategize about what the messaging should be, the way that Sean Hannity did when Donald Trump was in the White House. I mean, that's just a false comparison, in my opinion.
And from my perspective, listening to WAMC, is you go, oh, there's a story I forgot about. There's a variety there. If you listen to MSNBC or CNN, sometimes you get the same story over and over again. And with, at least with NPR, I'm hearing things about other places in the world. It's almost like the BBC. It's just a great variety because there is so much news happening in the world, and it's not all about what's happening in Washington.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, I am a great fan of NPR. I've said this, admitted this here.
Oh, you got a bias.
There you go. Well, just think of the range of stories that we get to hear, to know. And one of the great things about radio, I remember having this conversation 40 years ago, that in some ways, radio is the truest and clearest presentation of fact, because sound by itself gives you more than just words on the page, and it isn't distorted by the sort of jazziness of video that television news does. And so actually, it's really a great way to tell stories and a great way to digest what's going on. Okay, this is the Media Project for Northeast Public Radio, a public radio outlet, of course, which we are grateful is supported by listeners. I'm Rex Smith here with Ian Pickus and Barbara Lombardo and Judy Patrick. We are the Media Project. If you want to share your views, media@wamc.org is how you can send us your email, and we'll make some use of it the next time around. Let's talk a little bit about the Trump trial, because this is such a huge story in the U.S., and from a journalistic standpoint, there are two questions that come to mind quickly: how much to make of the story, and number two, how to get at the story when there are now restrictions. The judge in the so-called hush money trial, it's actually an illegal campaign contribution trial is actually what he's charged with, has ordered journalists in court not to report prospective jurors' answers to questions about their current and former employers. And those answers will also be redacted from court transcripts. What about this? I don't quite understand how it is possible. Judy, have you ever seen a judge actually order us not to report something?
Well, so I've covered jury selection many times, and like I've never reported the names and occupations, but it's more, as I remember, it's something you did voluntarily. And we have had instances where we have had judges tell you not to do something, not to report the name of a parent when the crime involves a child. You'd be surprised how often that happens. But we talk about prior restraint, which is something that is unconstitutional, especially when it comes to the press. Most oftentimes, what happens is, you know, the judge orders you to do it, but then the newspaper decides to do it, or the journalist decides to do it because it makes sense. We do it voluntarily. At this point, the judge is ruling that the reporters can only report the gender of the person and maybe the age and not the occupation. This comes, I should note, on the heels of Fox News or Fox, maybe we shouldn't call it Fox News, Fox reporting, going juror by juror and determining whether or not, making a decision about whether or not they can be biased or be fair to Donald Trump, and Donald Trump retweeting that in a post on his own Truth Social. So it's clear that these jurors are going to be under some pressure, and one juror, at least at this taping, has got dismissed. She had already been seated. She was able to convince the judge to let her go because she's worried, and perhaps justifiably so. Do I like the idea of a judge telling the media they can't report something? And do they think it will withstand a constitutional challenge? Probably not. I do appreciate the media's restraint, and I think they should exercise some when it comes to this.
So, Barbara, if a reporter came back to you and said, the judge just ordered me not to report the occupations of the jurors, what do you think I should do, boss?
Well, then we would be having the kind of conversation that we are having right now, which happens a lot in newsrooms, and I hope that listeners appreciate what kind of angst we have over important decisions like this. So I would say that, without giving it tons and tons of thought, that the right to freedom of the press doesn't mean that we have to print everything we know. And in trying to weigh the public, what questions that we ask ourselves is, what's the public's need to know? How does this benefit the public? What's the flip side to publishing information or broadcasting information? You know, do we really need to do it? Are we serving a public good? And I tend to err on the side of wanting to let the processes complete themselves correctly without the interference of the press. And if and I can see that the threats to the jurors are real.
By Trump supporters, you mean?
By Trump supporters, yes. And so I would tend to be sensitive to what the judge is asking. And I want to get this jury seated, and I want the trial to proceed, and I want to do my civic duty as a journalist. And so I would tend to pull back on what I was reporting about the jurors.
In real time, folks, we have the news director of WAMC here. And I'd like to say that the Associated Press had already reported the occupations of these people before the judge's, in effect, gag order on the press.
Of the six or seven that
of the
were
six
there.
Who were seated. And so, Ian, I'm about to read what the Associated Press reported. Let the record reflect that the news director is nodding. So it is a software engineer, an information technology professional.
Here we go.
Sales professional.
We're going to report
an
it.
An English teacher and two lawyers. That's why I wanted to make sure it was okay before. So call your counsel.
But this information will be available to anyone who wants to know it. So the question is, do you propagate it while it's happening or not? The thing I'm interested to see is there's always a window for the jurors at the end to meet the press and say, I'm going to tell you what we thought about in there. Here's my name. Here's what I thought. They can go through door A if they want to do that, or go through door B if they don't want to. And a lot of times it leads to a book deal, a sit-down interview on the Today Show. And I would be shocked if at least some of the occupation's owners you just named don't go down that road.
That is not always the case. Actually, there are instances where a judge will instruct from the bench, jurors, you are instructed not to speak to the media. We've had instances where judges have said, for 5 years, you are not to speak to the media. And again, I think that is an unconstitutional restraint. But if somebody doesn't challenge it, the order stands, I suppose, unless you want to defy the order and then see what happens, see if you're hauled into court and if for contempt of court. We'll see if something like that happens. But it's such a live issue that it is really being debated in the First Amendment press. I'm part of an organization called the New York Fair Trial Free Press Conference, and we do a couple of conferences every year. This very issue is pending for a seminar that we're doing on May the 1st, Law Day, in New York City, where we have created a hypothetical which actually foreshadowed this, because we have in this hypothetical this notion of a judge ordering an anonymous jury. There have been times where, if it weren't for the media interviewing jurors afterwards, we would not know about some misdeeds in the jury room. We wouldn't know about bad acts that ended up leading to an overturn of verdicts. So there is a powerful notion that there is some value to this kind of reporting. And by the way, it's constitutional. The right to a fair trial by a jury of their peers has always been interpreted by the courts to mean an open trial. And that is, therefore, an order like this sounds unconstitutional, not only in a First Amendment standpoint, but also from the Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial. So this is a pretty big deal.
So we can agree that the order itself is problematic, but then we still need to decide, what are we going to do about what they are requesting, what they are ordering? Will we accept it as a request? And what would you do?
I think I would go ahead and report it. And see what happens, you know. And
I'm the wuss in the room.
I don't know.
You remember, this came up in Georgia when the grand jury issued an indictment against Donald Trump, the former president, and by Georgia law, the grand jurors' names were released. And that,
wow, the grand jurors. Now that's really odd.
Right, all the names of the grand jurors. I even think their addresses were in the report.
And there were threats against them, right?
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. So this is not speculative. The difficulty is, once the toothpaste is out of the tube, you can't pull it back. When I was the editor of the paper in Troy many years ago, we had a difficult situation where a 12-year-old girl claimed that some teenage boys who she was hanging out with on a Saturday morning had raped her, and four boys, I believe, and they were hauled into court and charged with felonies and paraded before television cameras before the mom of the girl called our reporter a day and a half later and said, come over to our house and sit there with me. And I sent two reporters, and the girl said, I made it up. It wasn't true. The boys were already paraded before cameras. Their names had been released. It was a very difficult situation, but that was the decision of the district attorney to parade the boys in public. Really unfortunate, really unfortunate situation for the young men involved. And as soon as we found that the story was untrue, according to the girl, we refused to publish any more. It was before the days of the internet. You couldn't scrub your clips. But in any case, these are the kinds of ethical issues that we confront all the time, and we suddenly have run out of time.
Wow.
Isn't that great?
And we didn't even talk about the fact that none of this trial is being shown on video.
Right.
Which is a somewhat related problem.
It is. More on that next week, folks. You've been listening to The Media Project, and we thank you for joining us. That was Ian Pickus, Barbara Lombardo, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. With gratitude to our producer, David Castina, and with thanks to you for joining us once again this week, and come back next week for The Media Project.
got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the flow. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed...
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Substack columnist of the Upstate American, Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, former editor of the Daily Gazette and vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association, Barbara Lombardo, the former editor of the Saratogian and a journalism professor at the University at Albany, and WAMC news director Ian Pickus. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at wamcpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Now, newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now, publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.